duties, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of far. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Fireside Chats.
How's it going, Higher Side Chatters? You know the drill. Smoking a little smoke, drinking a little drink from sunny San Diego. I'm Greg Carlwood, and today we're going to swing back into the dark world of esoteric secret societies and their manipulation of everything we know, spirituality, culture, language, commerce, education. Nearly every aspect of the modern human experience has been shaped by their grubby little fingers, and I, for one, want to know more about it. But for an outsider, understanding the clear truth is like navigating a near infinite labyrinth of smoke and mirrors. And lucky for us, today's guest, Frater X, is a member of over 9 secret societies and esoteric orders, and he's going to break it down for us the best he can. But my feeble mind just isn't qualified to go it alone, so joining me here in the THC studio is my good friend and occasional co-host, publisher of Paranoia Magazine, the Holy Scriptures themselves. You know him, you love him, Ron Patton, how the hell are you?
Hey, I'm doing quite well, Greg. Thanks for having me on.
Of course. Well, man, it's been a sad 48 hours for me, honestly. I mean, just 2 nights ago, on the eve of the Blood Moon, one of the boldest voices for the voiceless, a brilliant teller of truth, and a powerful guest we had on CHC just 2 months ago, Michael C. Rupert, signed off from his own podcast, The Lifeboat Hour, and took his own life with a gunshot to the head. And it really pains me because I feel like Mike was dealing with the frustration of dedicating himself to fighting the corrupt power structure for decades, watching the planet and society decay, and seeing 95% of people stand by and do nothing. And I sympathize with that. And it's just kind of a sad day for our team, isn't it?
Yeah, Michael's been around for a while, and I think he's had a lot of profound influence on a lot of conspiracy researchers, and he's definitely stood the test of time as far as his credibility and his willingness to reveal the truth.
Yeah, man, I've already seen several alternative news sites and people come out and say, you know, don't believe the hype that it was a suicide. And I just say, you know, sometimes things really are just what they seem to be. And I'm not really surprised that he would do that. It seems like if you watched Apocalypse Man, if you listened to his recent interviews, he seemed like he had given up. I mean, he said in our interview, I asked him, you know, where's the hope for the future? And he basically said, there is none. We are in a situation of accepting defeat. And when someone is in that mind state, to hear something like this would happen isn't super surprising, although it is super frustrating to lose such a powerful voice in the alternative movement, you know, someone I really think we needed when our numbers aren't very strong anyway.
Right. And, you know, unfortunately, there's a lot of conspiracy theorists out there who every time there's some sort of big event or, you know, somebody in the conspiracy research community dies, they automatically think that, you know, it was a conspiracy. But what I like to do is wait for a while and let things kind of filter through and, you know, look at information from both sides and sort of weed out the crap and then hold on to it, to what seems credible. And, you know, again, unfortunately, I think he did take his own life. And, you know, if you don't have hope, I mean, what do you have to live for, really? That's what it comes down to. But I myself am hopeful, and hopefully I'll stay that way. But, you know, rest in peace, Michael Rupert.
Yeah, man. Well, depressing news aside, before we bring Frater X in here, what's been going on in the paranoia world?
Well, I recently moved to a bigger store. It's in, basically, it's in the same building on 630 C Street in downtown San Diego. So that's good. And then last night I just put together the final roster for the upcoming Paranoia Con, which is going to be August 2nd and 3rd, in the same building I have my store in. So I'm pretty excited about that. So I'll have all that information on my website, which is www.paranoiamagazine.com. And then also, to sort of coincide with that, I'm going to be sponsoring an art show the same time as the Comic-Con, so that'll be in mid-July. And the title of the art show is called Paranoia, Mind Control, and the Art of Illusion. So I'm really excited about those two upcoming events.
Yeah, man, those things sound awesome. The first Paranoia Con was great. Spent a lot of time hanging out with Adam Gorightly and Olav Phillips, who the audience should be familiar with. It was also the place where I met Lennon Honor, who has been one of my favorite guests on the show. So I would really encourage people to come out to that and support the alternative movement and meet some of these speakers that you hear on podcasts such as this one. Well, anyway, that said, I'm really looking forward to it. And Frederick, today's guest, is going to be a speaker there. I think he is ready for us to bring him in. So here's a little plug for the THC Money Bomb for anyone who wants to play the game and help the show at the same time. And Ron and I will be on the other side with Secret Society socialite Frederick. Hey people, I gotta take a second to tell you about something we do around here called the THC Money Bomb. What I do is every 5 episodes, I total up the donations I've gotten in that period of time, and half keeps me and the show going. I take the other half and I gift that back to a random listener. So far we're hitting about 500 each round, and I couldn't be happier about it. So consider throwing in 5 or 10 bucks. It's cheaper than a hand at the blackjack table with better odds than a scratch-off ticket. Plus, you know half supports a show you like, and at the very least, half will go to a like-minded person who could probably use a nice surprise in these troubled times. When you make a donation, I can see your email address, and that's how I pick the winner. But to keep things kosher, you can also get in the pool by sending your info on a postcard to me, Greg Carlwood, P.O. Box 635223, San Diego, California, 92163. I got no subscription fees here, no paid archives, no paid bonus shows, and I want to keep it that way, on principle. But I'm not a millionaire at the podcast on the side. This is it for me. And I'm the only one I know who's trying to help the people out as well.
That's my man!
So help me help you. If you want to play along, go to thehiresidechats.com/donate and get in the game. Dollars, bitcoins, it's all good to me. And that's what we call the THC Money Bomb. Boom. All right, people, I'll say it again, but as backwards as this world may seem, it hasn't happened by accident. Our modern society is the result of centuries worth of careful crafting by powerful groups that blanket our history, entertainment, education, and damn near everything with their influence. And while we live in a powerful age of information, it's increasingly difficult to find the truth and clarity among the various roadblocks of propaganda and misinformation. And that is one of the main reasons we brought in today's guest, a crucial researcher, lecturer, and author for these troubled times, and a personal member of 9 different esoteric orders, including the Knights Templar, the Ancient Order of the Druids, and the Masonic Rosicrucians, just to name a few. He's a master of masonry, a secret society socialite, and a teller of sacred truth. Frederick, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much, Greg. I'm just excited to be here. I'm glad that we could finally get this interview. I'm sorry about the reschedule, but, you know, when you get sick, nature takes over. You can't really call the shots, you know?
Yeah, man. No worries. No worries. I'm super psyched to have you here as well. And I have to say, I like you and I like your work, but a lot of listeners will hear member of 9 secret orders and get a little bit skeptical. I mean, we've had Masons on the show before who usually paint their brotherhood in a positive light, kind of equating them to nothing more than a couple of buddies having a beer and reading up on the Hermetic texts. But clearly some of these folks, they've shaped our world for the worse. With so much deceit, how can you tell who's really on the right side of the people, man?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. And that's what we'll set about to do in this chat today, you know, is try to unpack that. And, you know, rest assured to all your listeners, could think of me as an infiltrator. I mean, I'm about on the precipice of complete resignation from most of the Masonic orders as we speak. I've already started to withdraw from different orders, you know, and honestly, one of the main reasons is economics. You got to keep up with these dues and all these orders. It costs a lot of money, and I really can't afford it personally. I mean, the whole quest I had was a quest for knowledge and quest for understanding to try to demystify this whole this whole thing. And, you know, exactly as you said, there are plenty of people that can tell you, oh, you know, Masonry is just a bunch of old guys planning a barbecue or a pancake breakfast, you know, and charitable organizations. And yeah, it is all that too. But what people don't realize is that when somebody joins Masonry, that opens them up for membership in, some say, over 1,000 different side orders and organizations that you don't even know exist until they tap you to join.
Yeah, man, that's one of the weirdest aspects of it. And sometimes it seems almost like trivial, all these different offshoots, kind of like offshoots of religions, you know, Baptist, Lutheran, and it's like a little bit silly. It's like, what's so different? Like, why do we need all this? And I kind of get that vibe from Masonry secret societies as well. But, I mean, what are the major differences here? And, I mean, at the top, are they all kind of working together towards the same goal, or are they all kind of fighting for pieces of the power pie, or how exactly is this situation structured?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both those things, but I think that you can think of it as one of those Russian dolls where the doll fits inside the doll, which fits inside the doll all the way down, you know, until you got this really tiny doll. Right. That's like the smallest little group of bankster thugs, you know what I mean, that are like in this little side order called the Brotherhood of Banksters or whatever. I don't even know what they are because I'm not a bankster, you know what I mean? But you got to be one to join, right? And that's how it is. It's all about, you know, misdirection of awareness and keep 3-card Monty, follow the queen, keep it moving, you know, so you never really know. All you know is one guy seems to be a member of all these specific groups, and he's also in the Trilateral Commission or the, you know, Council on Foreign Relations, right, too. Or he's in the Century Club, or he's, you know, former CIA, you know, which is not real. You can't really be former CIA. But right at the very top of Masonic education in America today is S. Brent Morris, who I personally met outside of Washington, D.C., who told me right to my face that he was in the CIA cryptography department. And that he was, you know, that was his job when he wasn't writing the Complete Idiot's Guide to Freemasonry, which is what he wrote. And that's what he's the guy you see, the bald guy on History Channel or any of the other ones with the kind of has a bird face with glasses.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah.
And he's freakishly tall, too, by the way. I don't know if that has anything to do with anything, but, you know. But yeah, guys, I mean, bottom line is, there is a secret war on human consciousness, and that's my battle cry right now. I'm promoting that. I wrote an article that was published in Paranoia Magazine, the fall issue. I was so psyched to be a part of the 50th anniversary JFK assassination issue of Paranoia Magazine, and you know, which I consider a prestigious conspiracy reader among all the other literature out there, you know. And I'm glad to have our friend Ron Patton with us, right?
Yeah.
Hey, Frederax. Hey. I'm really honored that you were able to write for us for that particular issue. And you have another article coming up, don't you?
Yeah, you're like, come on now, where is it, pal, right? Yeah, I'm working on a new article. I'm calling it Fallen Angels. Basically, it's Giants, Monsters, and Dark Occulted Mystics in America, where I'm talking about this very thing, you know, looking at the dark side of politics and social engineering, you know, and how it all fits in with these fraternal, you know, Western tradition fraternal orders, and how the concentric rings line up, really, you know, and lead us to this military industrial complex empire we're all, you know, trying to survive in today, right?
Right. So what are you going to be talking about at the ParanoiaCon this coming August?
Well, you know, I actually just came back from Austin, Texas, where I kind of touched upon a lot of the stuff that I'm going to go over in the research. I mean, we basically everything I had to say, it was funny. It was like they were just so receptive to the talks about, well, first of all, let's talk about the Nephilim. I don't know how many people out there even know what this term is, but it's a real hot topic right now. As a matter of fact, it's one of the tag terms that is the highest hitter on all my, you know, media outlets online. Huh. Nephilim, fallen angels, Noah, the flood, you know, black magic, all these things are connected. And I just did a show about Noah, the Nephilim, and the flood on a different radio interview, and it's online. You can find it very easily just by a real quick search. But we're going to touch upon a lot of this in the new article and presentation at the ParanoiaCon, We're going to talk about the it's like a hidden history that's right within, you know, hidden in plain sight once again, but excised from the Bible, for example, but in many cultures around the world. And it turns out right here in America, it turns out, you know, in the 19th century, they were digging up giant and weird, strange creature remains all over America with impunity. And everyone was completely okay with the idea that there was races of giants running around in North America thousands of years ago. I mean, even Abraham Lincoln gave a speech in the 1840s where he mentioned the giants who were peering at the mound building giants of North America, and their, you know, how long ago they had been looking at Niagara Falls, because he was at Niagara Falls giving a speech. And he made this offhand reference to the giants and the connection with the mound builders, which people who don't realize there are thousands, you know, there are mounds all over North America, which have been attributed to various cultures and tribes of Indians and ancient, you know, civilizations, that it just goes on and on, the speculation. But what we know for certain is that the evidence has been suppressed. Every account I've looked into with talks of giants or strange creatures that have been dug up in America, we find the Smithsonian Institute steps in and takes over everything, takes all the evidence and sweeps it all away. And it's like rolled into that big room where they've got the, you know, the Ark of the Covenant with all the boxes with no labels on them, you know?
Yeah.
They're like, oh, it's gone. We don't know what happened to it. But out there in California, right on Catalina Island off the coast of L.A., there was a giant museum that was run by the Wrigley family until the 30s in America.
No way, really?
Yeah. They actually exhumed thousands of giant remains out of caverns on Catalina Island, created a giant museum, and they were selling pieces of giant bones in the gift shop. They had 500 photos of all the evidence. People from all over the world came and viewed them. And then the Smithsonian Institute carted away all the remains after they shut it down in the 30s. Never saw any of that stuff again. Just gone. Wow. I mean, there was one giant remain that was pulled out of a hole in the ground in Ohio, right on the border of Ohio and Indiana, that was 18 feet tall. He had a 9-foot-long iron sword and an iron helmet. And people from all around, hundreds of people came and viewed it in a big, you know, they sold tickets for tourists to come and look at it. And then it was carted off by the Smithsonian Institute, never to be seen again. I mean, it just keeps going on and on. Now, why do I keep talking about giants? I mentioned the Nephilim, right? Well, in the scripture, in Bible, Old Testament, Genesis chapter 6, there is a reference to when men began to multiply on the earth and the daughters of Adam were born, the sons of God or the sons of heaven saw how beautiful the daughters were, and so they took them for their wives and they bred with them and they created these, what they said in one, you know, depending on the translation, one of them says giants, monsters, strange beasts, heroes of renown. So heroes of renown is thrown in with monsters and strange beasts and giants, you know, like Hercules or Perseus or Theseus or any of those guys. And what we have is a real dot connector, if you will, because you start realizing that when you look in all the cultures of the world, you have these stories of demigod-like heroes and supermen that do these amazing things. And you wonder where that comes from. Right? Well, there's this monomyth, maybe, that these giants or these beings came down from the heavens and bred with the daughters of Adam, right? And had half-breed hybrids that they called the Nephilim. The beings that came down in the scripture, like in the Book of Enoch, which is a non-canonical text, and, you know, meaning it's not included in the Bible canon, but it was still a book that, you know, Jesus mentioned Enoch something like 30 plus times in the New Testament. I mean, he was a very important figure, but for some reason they saw fit to excise that book. But the Book of Enoch, of course, was in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And it was, in fact, you know, it was a book that was very, very important, you know. Mm-hmm. But according to the Book of Enoch, that was the real reason for the flood, was that these watchers came down. That's what they were called, the watchers, the fallen angels. They came down, they bred with the humans, and they also taught them a bunch of dark, spooky stuff. According to the Book of Enoch, they taught them black magic and necromancy and all the strange arts that were, you know, out of order with heaven and the order of things at the time. That's now we're just looking at one version of events, but
yes,
but you know, there's more than one. If you look across the cultures into the, even in America, back with the Mesoamerican tribes, you had many Indian cultures. The Paiute Indians, there was a book written in the 19th century called Life with the Paiutes, where they talked about fighting a giant race. They had to actually kill them because they were eating humans. They were cannibals. Huh. They were, you know, and they were eating all the food and eating the humans, and they were monsters. So they had to drive them into a big cavern in the ground, and then they burned them up. They burned them out. And I mean, that's the Paiute. So every culture has this reference to killing off giants a long time ago. So, okay, what's the point? The point is, when you look at secret societies, one of the main reasons why I got involved in researching the rituals and the ceremonies is because the secrets that are contained within secret society, what were the, you know, what are the secrets? What's the kernel? What's the seed truth in the very center that this whole system has been unfolded and, you know, developed out of? Well, what you find when you look in the center is you find a perennial theme over and over again, certain symbols, certain emblems, certain themes being repeated. And one of them is interaction with preternatural beings that are extra dimensional, if you will, hyperdimensional. They call them egregores. It's a strange term. It comes from the Greek. It goes back to, though, the watchers, to the angels, to the euangelium, the messengers of the divine. But it's a sort of, you know, it's a dark side to it. You know, it basically how it goes is this. In the Book of Enoch, it talks about God actually caused the flood to happen to wipe out all the blasphemy, all the abominations that have occurred with the breeding of the angels and man. And this, you know, I imagine it as the time of like Conan, you know, with like sorcerers and, you know what I mean? Temple is set, you know, all kinds of crazy stuff going on. But during that time, they wiped them out, you know, and the thing about these Nephilim, these offsprings of angels and man, they're half divine and half earthbound, half mortal. So when they were killed off, their souls were bound to the earth. This is the legend that's in the Book of Enoch. They could not be released. So these spirits of the dead Nephilim actually become, in my thinking and in many other people's thinking, the evil spirits that haunted humanity for the last couple millennium. And you know, one more thing to say to cap that off, what people don't realize is the Nephilim and the Watchers were interacting on the earth for over a millennium. Because from the time of Jared in the Bible to the time of Noah, and Noah was 600 years old, they said in the Bible, when the flood happened. From the time of Jared to that time of Noah, who Jared was Noah's great-great-great-grandfather, his name means born in the time of the descent, meaning the time of the Watcher's descent. So from that time to Noah was 1,196 years. That's how long the Watchers interacted with humanity before the flood happened. So you think about that, these evil spirits, and you wonder about rituals and groups of people that come together and do a thing in ritual pattern over and over again, and what kind of energy thought being would form around, especially with the intent of some individuals not being, you know, the best intentions.
Yeah, man, that's a powerful story there. I mean, I've heard a lot of that before from other guests who talk about some of the secrets within these orders. And it seems weird to me because I wonder what the real goal is, because in modern times, I would assume it's just wealth and power and control, but it always seems to be so rooted in things in like biblical texts and ancient texts and traditions and symbols. And I just wonder if all that is really so necessary for wealth, control, and power.
Well, I think, you know, what happened is a long time ago, what happened really, you know, if you want to put it into a grand scale for expansive view right now of the latest human history, I think 10 to 13,000 years ago, there was a giant worldwide cataclysm, probably one of many, but a really big one. And it really wiped out a lot of stuff. I mean, it wiped everything out and most people, 90% probably. And the ones that were left were like in post-traumatic stress disorder shock, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, all of humanity as a whole collective consciousness was probably knocked offline. And at that point, there was some other extra species consciousness. I don't know if it was outside or inside, but it was a pathogen, a mind virus that infested our species. And this predator understood human mindscape and understood that we could be, you know, brought back online in a safe mode, like after a computer crashes, and kept in really, really simple applications and platforms, you know, and that then like this collective disorder was, you know, would divert enough of humanity away from its tribal hunter-gatherer subsistence existence into a, you know, city-state control structure where accumulation and profit is gold, you know, and that existence where authority was justified by a select priesthood that was chosen for its obedience and its skill with perpetuating the ruling paradigm that just reinforced by military might of the state, whether it be a dictatorship or a republican. A republic, it really makes no difference, right? Because it just, you just need to have like the control meme, you know, like a civic mythology that just keeps everybody in line. And so we are really, really susceptible to suggestion. Humanity as a species, we're very, very highly prone to error. We make mistakes, you know, we make mistakes. I make mistakes all the time, right? Yeah. And we're prone to that. And we're prone to novelty too. We're prone to doing crazy things like completely off the wall and out of left field, like didn't see that one coming. You know what I mean? That's a good thing, though, really. That's what's going to save us in my mind, because the control structures don't know what to do with novelty. They don't know how to handle, you know, completely off the wall behavior, unpredictable behavior, non-compliance. Unpredictable non-compliance is the way of the revolution, as far as I'm concerned.
You know? I'm with you, man. And that explanation makes a lot of sense to me, too. I mean, considering the secretive nature of these orders and the Masonic connections to being architects and builders, there seems to be an element of pushing the planet towards a global disaster, like another cataclysm today, so that they can come in and once the slate has been wiped clean, now their traditions of building and architecture would be very useful and they could quickly start rebuilding and get us under their thumb again. You think that's the reason for these orders remaining such secrecy over centuries and generations to be in that power position?
Absolutely. You're hitting upon some really important factors, because see, what we know is that a long time ago, catastrophe was commandeered and utilized to coerce humanity through fear into like routine patterns of mediocrity, you know, steeped in narrow bandwidths of potentiality, like what's possible, what can we really accomplish,
right?
So that people would stay, you know, in a herded mentality, you know, keep your head down and watch out for the disasters, you know, we're here to help, we're here to save. And these secret orders have utilized for building tools. Absolutely. Not only is it invokes, you know, it retroactively invokes a genetic memory in us all, because who were the most important people after disasters? Builders, people who can rebuild. You want the guy that knows how to build right up front, and he's, you know, get him calling the shots. So who becomes the leader? A builder, you know, because he can call the shots. He tells you what to do. You guys go over there and get rocks. You guys go over there and get wood. You guys start digging a hole. We're going to make a house right here. You know what I mean? That's the way it is. And so that's why they assume the position of hierarchy, you know, the priesthood is the builders. And so they're invoking that memory in us from the past, but absolutely keeping us always anxious for the coming shortage, the great limitation of cataclysm that's coming. Everybody be afraid, be very afraid. It's going to happen any second. The world's going to open up wide. We're all going to fall in. You know?
Yeah, man. It seems like fixing society today would be insurmountably hard, because the manipulation is so powerful and multi-layered and so embedded in our culture and our knowledge of history, and even our very language is manipulated to make us think one way or another. It seems so hard to get the programming out of anyone. I mean, do you think this could ever be done?
Yeah, you know, George Orwell wrote an article called The Politics of Language. You know, and there's a book called General Semantics by Alfred Korzybski, which talks about how language is used to structure reality. Robert Anton Wilson talks a lot about that as well. This is the reality, folks. We are living in the most mentally controlled period of humanity, I think. And it's, you know, it's helped along tremendously by the internet, obviously. Because, I mean, for every service the internet provides, it also enslaves us all, because we're all caught up in a consensual reality, right?
100% agree. I'm seeing that more and more. I used to think the internet was the global elite's biggest mistake, but now I'm seeing more tools of use for it for their side.
Because everybody revels in the information age, and it's a delightful time. But I feel like we're falling into another dark age. You know, I mean, we're really, people are, I, you know, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king, and I'm feeling pretty kingly. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, man.
I mean, it's what it comes down to. And, you know, getting into it, when you talk about, is there any hope? You know, it's like, I don't know, Greg. I don't know, because, man, listen, we had a revolution in this country 250 years ago, you know, give or take or whatever, you know, but what happened, right? I mean, before the revolution even ended, the bankster thugs already had a charter for a central bank set up in America before they even signed the Treaty of Paris. And then that's the real core issue here. I keep talking about bankster thugs, because it is that mentality of creating wealth out of nothing and feeding upon the production of others. That's what banks are all about. They're wealth extraction devices. They're brought in to prevent people from prospering. I mean, that's the key. And we saw it happen in America right away. First, you know, the first central bank in America was founded by Alexander Hamilton, right? You know, he was thought to be a friggin' Illuminati agent, even then, Rothschild agent, right? He sets up a central bank. It fails completely. They didn't even renew the first charter, because all it did was cause financial ruin in its wake. I mean, it was the worst possible thing that could have happened. And so what do? They set up another one, right? They set up another one. It goes, this time they give it a longer charter, so it can't be shut down as quick, right? Same thing. 1811, when they were supposed to renew the charter, they wouldn't renew it. Congress wouldn't. And guess who made a big stink about it? Nathan Rothschild, English banker from the International Bankster Thugs. He actually threatened America and said, if you don't do this, then we're going to friggin', you'll be blood in the streets, right? Everybody knows what happened. 1812, we went to war. And what happens when we go to war? We go into debt to bankers because we borrow money for the war. And then when we got out of the war, when they wrote up the papers and signed, we had to sign a charter for another central bank right then and there. Yeah. That's how the whole thing was planned, to get us back onto a central banking system, so that we get to the turn of the century, you know, Jekyll Island and the birth of the Federal Reserve banking system, which is the perfection of wealth extraction. And the first thing that happens, right, in 1933, our FDR is made president, they go ahead and they put out the 1934 Gold Act, which tells all Americans they have to surrender their gold immediately or they'll be put in jail for 10 years, and they get $20.66 per ounce of gold that they turn in, right? So when the Federal Reserve ends up with all the gold, then they turn around and 2 years later, they raise the rate of gold from $20.60 to $35 an ounce, which makes a $3 billion profit for the Federal Reserve. And then after that, that's the last time they audit the gold in Fort Knox. Nobody even realizes that what happens very quietly for the next 50 years is they shift the gold from Fort Knox into the vaults of the Federal Reserve under the auspices of collateral for continued money production and the debt that's created from the interest on the bills that they're printing for us. And so when Ronald Reagan tries to bring us back on the gold standard, they do an audit. Well, they can't even do a real audit. They're not allowed to. It's like all these, you know, red tape and everything. But what they find out, number one, is there is no gold in Fort Knox. It's all in the Federal Reserve, and they're holding it as collateral for all the money that we owe them now for them doing what Congress can already do according to the Constitution, right?
Yeah.
But that's really what it's about, and that's the sad and simple truth. I used to think there was some, you know, I mean, there is some dramatic and scary stuff that are going on all over the place. We can speculate and recount all kinds of crazy tales of dark occulted mysticism everywhere. But in the bottom line, it seems as if it's really just about money and banks and greed.
Right. And Frauderex, there has... within recent history, there's been a few conspiracy researchers who've surmised that there are like 13 Illuminati families that essentially run the world. One being Johnny Todd back in the 1980s, and more recently, Fritz Springmeier, who wrote a book called The 13 Illuminati Bloodlines. What do you think of that theory? Is there any credence to it?
Well, I think so. First of all, I've met Fritz at the Free Your Mind Conference, too. He's a really great guy. He's a gentle spirit. I mean, the man is just amazing. His life story and what he's gone through and his ability to be as positive as he is amazing. It really is a testament, I think, to, you know, what the human will can accomplish and overcome, you know. But he definitely has hit upon something. I don't know what the numbers are. I've heard all kinds of different, you know, 80 families. I've heard the 13 families, but in the end, yeah, there's definitely and it's a bankster family. That's what it is. It's a financial institution family, a legacy of financiers who are, you know, the ones setting the standards. You know, they just basically probably possess all the most important resources and all the gold.
Yeah. And dude, in your Free Your Mind conference presentation, you did a great job of breaking down all the false flags that have dragged us down a war path for almost all of America's existence, which you just chronologized in terms of financing and gold. But this stuff, I guess it shouldn't be news to anyone here. You know, we should all be kind of awakened to that pattern. But how do you see them twisting it for modern times? I mean, what's the trajectory of their plan? Do you see any new tricks that they're working on that we should be aware of?
Well, I think that it's old tricks being rehashed and reapplied.
Yeah, reintroduced.
It's always about co-opting trends and cycles, you know, and fads and points
Sorry to cut you off, but do you think that right there is their management of that novelty you were talking about?
I think that's the way that they keep us captivated, is by inserting as much of their own, you know, counterfeit stimuli right alongside whatever's driving the latest novelty. So there's constantly an overlaying and overlaying and overlaying of repetitive themes. That's why you see so many formulaic media, you know, vehicles. It's all formulaic. It's all retrofit, retrograde. You keep seeing remakes of everything, and you know you see the new version of an old theme. It's always like that because that keeps us thinking in those ways. So that when they put out a deliberate, evocative theme, something they want you to think about, like exploiting Masonic or Egyptian iconography, using that in 1970, SRI, the Stanford Research, they put out a report telling the government that the best way to herd the American collective consciousness was to use Masonic and Egyptian iconography, you know, and that we were all headed in the 21st century to a mass awakening. And if you wanted to shepherd us in one direction or another, then you better use these symbols and emblems to do it. And look what happened. Look at the movies and music and television saturated in Masonic and Egyptian iconography for the last 30 years, 40 years, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's weird because I do see that symbolism, but I want to talk about that for a little bit because, I mean, we're used to seeing the symbolism used by secret orders and corporate overlords and media and movies, and it almost seems like superstitious in a way. I mean, how would you explain the power of symbolism to people, and is there a way people can use the same energies that apparently back these symbols for good in their own life?
Okay, well, one way to look at it, I think, is this. With all spiritual or metaphysical systems, like systems of approach that are trying to make contact with beyond that which lays beyond the physical, beyond the five senses, right? So you're trying to make contact or have an effect or impact from that direction. Yeah. And in doing so, it's a reflective nature. The whole as above, so below, right? So it's reflective. What symbols represent to us here are ideas, and people are the living things. But in the spiritual realm, the symbols and the emblems are the living things, and people represent aspects or ideas of characteristics of self. Does that make sense?
It does. But I just wonder if people haven't been introduced to the meanings behind these symbols, how does it still have an effect?
Because it's already imprinted in us. I believe in genetic memory. Our consciousness, we have a core consciousness that we're all rooted to, I believe. We're all slices or divisions or copies or, you know, clones, mm-hmm. if you will, of a greater whole. And in the division, contained within each piece is the whole entirety. You know, the greater reality within each piece, mm-hmm. in that sense, you know, if you grasp the fractal reality, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so in that sense, we have everything contained within us. We are in fact, a living symbol ourselves of the divine on that level. So we are the living symbol ourselves and contained within, almost like a living, breathing sigil, which is a layered symbol, a symbol upon symbol upon symbol. So it's a little abstract, I know, but in the end, we have those symbols already imprinted or encoded within our consciousness.
Yeah, that seems to make sense. As I start to learn more about the symbols themselves and the history behind them, it starts to be easier to step outside of the situation and kind of look at what's happening. And that is something I've had a previous guest say as well, that by exposing the magic, by exposing the symbols, their spell is lessened, which I think that's part of all of our awakening process. And I guess that's really the best thing we can do with it.
Yes, it is. It is, because it sort of demystifies, you know, it sort of dispels the effect. We are under a global enchantment here. It's a mass enchantment, you know, and, you know, true secret societies in the best sense was about sequestering and preserving human knowledge while humanity went through whatever dark age it was currently under the throes of. And then it's sort of like an ebb and flow to human consciousness. There's a time when humanity kind of just like, you know, shrinks back into caves and underground and wants nothing to do with anything highfalutin or higher thinking. You know, it's all barbaric or whatever, right? And then eventually people start to come back to that way of wanting to explore those other concepts and higher ideals. And so the secret societies are just groups that form around the ideas to maintain and preserve. That was the intention. The problem is that there are those who were involved in that who broke away and decided that they were going to use those same tools to enslave and entrap people. You know, it's, you could say, to use simplified terms, it's like having the light and the dark side of Star Wars, you know?
Yeah.
And you got the Illuminators. The Illuminators are the Jedi. They are the way showers, the light guides, the ones that lead people to their own full integration and self-actualization, you know? While the other school, the Sith, you know, they're like the Illuminati, the captivators. They entrap and enslave their inheritance, bind them to false realities, to lies, to dead-end rabbit holes and little cul-de-sacs of awareness and knowledge that keeps them, you know, caught up in the simulated inorganic chaos. Yeah, the Greeks had a term for it. They called it the stereoma. The stereoma was the counterclock world that Philip K. Dick talks about. And you know, I think we all know which one the so-called masters of this world, the powers that shouldn't be, prefer, you know, what school they're using, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's what I was going to ask you next, is it seems today that whenever I see these symbols used, it's always by a powerful organization, a rich organization, extracting more wealth from the masses. And I'm wondering, I mean, are there illuminators left, or is it all just the dark side? I mean, is there anyone fighting for good still?
Well, you know, I mean, George Carlin said once, you know, it's not all of humanity is bad. It's just enough or bad to screw it up for the rest of us. But he used a different term, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, it's just enough or bad to tip the scales in the wrong direction, it seems. I like to think, you know, I hear you, Greg. I mean, who knows? I come from an optimistic position. I have four children. I have a wife. I have a family. You know, we're trying to raise people in this world. So I believe that in my experience, most people are good that I've come into contact with. Most people that I cross paths with every day are just good, law-abiding citizens that, you know, for the most part, that you, unless the laws are stupid, and they, you know, but they go about their business. They don't want to harm people. They don't want to exploit people. They just want to be left to do what they want to do, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's, so my experience has been that humanity is not fallen, is not evil, is good. But the power that controls humanity is corrupt, and a corruption that is in the core of the system, it bleeds out into all the extremities, so that we're all under the effect of it. You can't even get up and go out into the world without being an accomplice, a co-conspirator in this evil that we're engaged in, you know?
That's a great point.
It is. I mean, and it's sad to say, but we can do something. It's like we were saying, non-compliance, you know, abstract non-compliance. I remember watching an old Terrence McKenna video from back in the 80s. He was at like the Esalen Institute or something. He was breaking down, you know, probably the similar stuff that we've talked about right here today, you know? And he was putting it out there and he was saying just about exactly like I'm saying, like, we're totally screwed, man, right? And the guy in the audience goes, well, what do we do, man? What's the answer? If that's the case, you know, what's the solution? And without even batting an eyelash, without even thinking about it, McKenna shouts right back, or, you know, he throws it right back at him, art. Art is the answer. Creativity, yeah. You know, total novelty, humor. That's the answer. That really is. That's why, you know, that's our hope, is that we have that luminous epinoia that the Greeks call the creative visualization and imagination, that's like a spark within each one of us. And it can't be controlled. It can't be harnessed except by the individual who possesses it and then expresses it to everybody else. And that's our only hope, is that each one of us gets in touch with that and says, you know what? I'm not going to play your stupid reindeer games. I'm going to do this instead. That's what John Lash, who wrote a book called Not in His Image, and he has a website called metahistory.org. He talks about that the Greeks predicted, the Gnostics predicted, that at the last minute, at the 11th hour, when all hope seems lost, right before humanity goes into the abyss, we'll just say, you know what? We'll lift our heads and we'll be like, this is a bunch of bullshit. We're out of here. And we'll just shrug off the yokes and walk away and go off into the woods, you know, and give it up. And that's hopeful to me.
Yeah, man. I mean, that sounds excellent.
Yeah.
And when you're talking about the corruption being in the center of the system and it bleeds out, I mean, I completely vibe with that, because I hear a lot of people talking about little things that are wrong, this or that, on different layers of the onion. And they pose a solution that to me is like, no way will that change things. And I start to think about how huge a change we would need to really root out that corruption, because it is so, it's so systematic. It has created a system that incentivizes evil behavior. You know, capitalism itself, you know, the worship of money. I mean, we, all of us in America, should feel a little guilt each day because people are dying on the other side of the planet so we can have a prettier, nicer, cleaner cage than the rest of the planet. And the whole world is kind of just waiting for us to stop being okay with it.
I hear you. And, you know, the only problem is that American public has been stripped of its critical thinking. The American public has no capacity to critically think its way out of the situation. I mean, it's not surprising, because there was a system put into effect a long time ago that was, you know, there's a guy named John Taylor Gatto. He wrote a bunch of books, a couple of them. One of them is called Underground History of American Education. That's an excellent book. But he also wrote another one, a little book called Dumbing Us Down. And in this book, he speculates that in colonial America at the time of the Revolution, at least among the non-slave citizens, that literacy was nearly 100%, he believes. That, you know, let that sink in for a moment, everybody. 100% literacy. Okay? Now, among the slave classes, he said there was 75% literacy. Now, we know that literacy was high because, you know, propaganda was what was the way that the revolution was fought. The famous pamphleteers like Thomas Paine, whose Common Sense sold 600,000 copies to 3 million colonists. That's a lot of copies to a small, you know, only 3 million people, 600,000. And you know those people handed those out to somebody else. So probably 50% of the population got a copy of that, right?
Yeah.
And that means that, have you ever read Common Sense? That is not light reading. You know, that's not James Patterson or Judith Krantz.
Right.
But that brings up another point, which is the literacy, the scale of the literacy standard. You try to define literacy today in America, I couldn't do it. I can't find a proper scale to go on. You know, you can't find a qualified speculations based on – it's all varied criteria.
Yeah.
Like, it seems literacy standard today is based more on a simplified approach to writing, as in you are considered literate if you can read and follow instructions on how to build a barbecue.
Yeah, and the other thing, Frauder X, is that our whole education system is so linearly based, you know. Critical thinking or logical thinking is pretty much thrown out the door. And so we just pretty much go by, you know, rote style of learning. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would. It's all our education system is in America is obedience training. You learn three things in any school, any public school and most private schools, I would say, because I've been to both. And most of them have only three things to teach you. Number one, show up on time. Don't be tardy. Don't be late. That's like a moral offense. It's a moral dilemma. You better show up on time. That's building bad work skills, you know, for the future. That's the number one rule. Number two, you better observe your, you know, obey your keeper. Obey the master, obey the teacher, do what you're told, and then, you know, that's key. Number two, obedience. Number three, do some mindless rote activity till the bell rings and then walk away. Don't take it with you like it never happened. That's what you learn in America for
school. Yeah, man. I totally agree. And another element of schooling that's interesting is we're talking about these secret societies that have been running the show for generations, and they're built on a model of cooperation. Yet if you cooperate within school, it's called cheating, and it's one of the worst things you can do. It's all individuals. But yet behind the scenes, it's these groups that really run the show.
Exactly. Exactly. And you know, you find when I've studied this, I'm writing a book right now called The Secret War Inside Freemasonry. And you know, I'm looking at the early founding of compulsion schooling in America. I talked a little bit about it in my article in Paranoia, and I've talked about it in my different presentations. But what we find when we look closely, it's crazy. There was this one guy, his name was Davis. He was a minister in Rochester, New York in 1830, you know, right after the William Morgan affair. And he got run out of town. He was a Unitarian minister who was accused of having a lodge of the Illuminati held in his church. And so he was connected to what's this mysterious group of Masons called Scotch Masons, who consider themselves above reproach from any other Mason. They're like a high class Mason within Masonry that has, you know, like it's almost like the Supreme Council 33rd. They can't be answerable to anybody else. And that's what these Scotch Masons are in history were called. And so basically, he was associated with them. He runs for his life from Rochester. He goes across the Great Lake regions and ends up in Michigan, where he's appointed the first minister of education in the state of Michigan's new education system, which was the first compulsion schooling system in America. And he becomes the first minister of education to try out this new fledgling compulsion schooling system that was then, you know, stepped up and expanded across the entire nation.
Yeah, God, it just seems so hard to fight a machine that's that calculated and it's been that well oiled. But I want to talk a little bit before we go about magic and these elements in these secret societies, because we hear about this past, I mean, you touched on it earlier, a past where positive magic, Gnosticism was common among the people, and we have this this idea in our heads of a past human paradise. And I just wonder if this magic was used today, reintroduced to the people, because it's made to sound almost worthless in modern society, at least for commoners. But if it was reintroduced in a positive way and people started practicing some of this occult knowledge in a widespread way, what kind of effect do you think it would have? Is it really that strong?
Well, I think that it's important to realize that magic hasn't gone anywhere. I mean, it may not be in the forefront of our consciousness.
Right, right.
But it's just a term. You know, the idea is that these terms like occult, magic, hermetic, esoteric, they've all been misapplied, misused, and misdirected so much that it's clouded the true meanings of these things. And magic, for the working definition, is merely causing change in accordance with will, whether it be change of your own personal consciousness or change in your general environment around you. And that's a very pragmatic and utilitarian definition of it. And in that way, we are all conducting magical operations every day of our lives, because we're all engaging in activities in which we're using our will to cause change, you know, and that's really what it's about. But what the difference is that magic launches from the belief that potential and possibilities are limitless, and that we have an ability, a route to the metaphysical or the greater reality beyond the five senses. So magic takes it as a tacit belief just like religion does, that there is a metaphysical reality, a reality beyond this physical reality that we're all engaged in. And so once a person has that belief, magic merely is a toolbox for which they might become more acquainted with that metaphysical reality. And so from that perspective, for myself, I believe that magical teachings, esoteric systems, spiritual systems, occult sciences, all those, you know, hermetic arts, whatever you want to call them, the Western occult tradition or the hidden teachings that were forbidden and suppressed for so long by the church, these are methods for anyone who feels so inclined to become greater acquainted with their own inner self. And we know that that is really, you know, above the Oracle of Delphi was the quote of Thales, which said, "Know thyself and know the secrets of the universe." You know, that's an implied teaching in Hermetics, like as above, so below. And so these things are totally relevant. Because I believe, as do many other thinkers out there, I mean, Joseph Campbell was one of them, the John Lash I spoke of earlier, and many other researchers and writers and media content providers all believe that we've had something vital stripped from our awareness. It was part of the process of getting to where we are today in this postmodern world of completely controlled factors and, you know, the optimizing of production value, you know, of the human resources. Mm-hmm. And that's really where we're at. It all happened with the Industrial Revolution. And that's when, you know, things shifted, where we began to shift. And it was really important. You mentioned earlier about inhumane acts, where it was really important to condition the human animal, first of all, to see himself as an animal, and to condition himself to be willing and capable to perform inhumane acts against his environment and his fellow species. Because that's where profit comes from, you know, mm-hmm. is the, how far are you willing to go, son? You know, are you a company man? Yeah, that's what it's all right. about. And so the definition of success is the man who is willing to step on the necks and exploit everyone around him. You know, the egalitarian spirit that started the fraternal orders that were then co-opted, turned into what they are today, had the other idea. It was the idea, as we said before, with the illuminators, the idea that we all are, you know, a family or brotherhood of humanity, and that we should have a safe place where we could come together and enjoy each other's fellowship and not fear being preyed upon by your fellow man sitting next to you. Because that's the society we live in today, where nobody wants to know their neighbors because they might be just casing the joint, trying to rip me off, you know?
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, man, we are all so scared of each other, and that's what makes it even harder. Again, with this cooperation thing, you know, these secret societies, they're cooperating, they're working together, they have loyalty to each other above all else, and on the outside, in the mainstream, people are afraid of their goddamn neighbors. You know, that seems like the mission accomplished. Where do we go from here? If you're going to be hopeful for the future, where do we attack them? What systems do we need to overcome?
Well, again, I just keep the same battle cry. It's the same mantra. Cultivating wisdom and critical thinking within is the only hope for each person. To be able to really cultivate a sense of knowledge and wisdom from what's available around you so that you can discern the BS that's being presented to you by the state and by those who would, you know, call themselves your keeper. And that's if you are aware enough or impassioned enough to even care, because a lot of people today are just asleep behind their digital devices. I mean, it's just, and we're all lulled into this false sense of security, but it's mired in a really terrible sense of shortage and scarcity. You know, we're all convinced by the petrochemical companies that the only viable energy we have comes from this really limited resource, you know, this petrolium and coal, you know, whatever resource, right? But it's ridiculous. We're surrounded by energy all around us, but we all have been lulled into this narrow bandwidth of potential possibilities where we won't believe, you know, what Mark Twain said. Mark Twain said, "It is far easier to fool a man than to convince him he's being fooled."
Yeah. That's a great statement. I love that quote.
Yeah.
But I guess the only thing is, to me, sometimes I get frustrated that we're in a perpetual state of education. And, you know, if I was in the elite and I was running the show and some of the slaves started to listen to shows like this and listen to researchers like yourself, As long as they just did that and there was no real action, I guess I'd be okay with it. You know, sometimes I worry that the community as a whole is like in this educational circle jerk. And meanwhile, we're still every day being manipulated in the same way.
Now, Greg, you make a great point. I think it's really important we watch out for that. We're always in the potential for atrophy. You know, with every moment of growth and expansion, there's contraction, you know, and expiration. I mean, it's happening all around us. And it's easy to be lulled into a, you know, another false sense of reality. And that's why, in the end, right? I mean, I really fall back on novelty, humor, you know, irony.
Yes.
Irony. Have fun with it, guys, because guess what? That's, you know, it's like that movie, what was it, Life is Good? The guy that was trying to make his kid feel good on the way to the gas chamber or whatever, you know? And it was like, I mean, in a way, it's what do we really believe about reality? That's what it comes down to. Because I believe once you start looking at these higher concepts that are, you know, packaged within these systems and become acquainted with and come into contact with the real true circuitry of the cosmos, you start to find yourself realizing that we're just coagulated light. That we merely are slowed down white light waves that are existing in a, you know, a photonic soup of other bent light waves and, you know, particles and molecules that are all intermingling. And, you know, when you look at it from a totally different perspective, you end up realizing it sort of takes you off the hook about worrying about things. That's why the Zen Buddhists have it right, man. There's a very famous koan I memorized a long time ago. It says, sitting quietly doing nothing, spring comes and the grass grows all by itself. That's important. I mean, that's really important as far as I'm concerned.
Wow. Well, man, it has been a blast. I've really enjoyed this interview. I've learned a lot. Ron's learned a lot. The people have learned a lot. What would you like to give us in terms of info about your website or what you're doing now, what you got coming up next?
Yeah, we just had a DVD release event in Austin, Texas a couple weeks ago, and I have the Secret War on Human Consciousness DVD is available on my website, which is Middle Chamber, the letter F, the letter X, .wordpress.com, middlechamberfx.wordpress.com. You can also find myself and my wife, who is my co-host of my weekly podcast, The Middle Chamber, which is on Facebook, Freighter X, Mater X, and The Middle Chamber page. And we're on Sync Book Radio Network. That's where we're our home network now. We moved from the former network we were broadcasting for a few years on. But basically, I'm looking forward to August. We're gonna be in the end of July. We're going to the Extraordinary Technologies Seminar Conference in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and to take some footage and be preparing for the release of another media vehicle, which is Conspiracy Science Theater, which will be brought from FreemanTV.com, and it's going to be a variety truther conspiracy video program, you know, video variety show.
Yeah.
And it's going to be really cool, and we're going to do some, there's going to be the video, the Middle Chamber video series is going to be on that, and I'm going to shoot some footage of the, you know, some summer footage from our travels. We're going to be going to San Diego in August for the Paranoia Con. And also, we're now on build to go to the Olympia, Washington, Olympia Sync Summit, which will be a conference for all the Sync Book writers from the Sync Book Press are going to be meeting in Olympia, Washington on August 8th and 9th, I guess. So we've got a lot of stuff going on. And of course, I'm working on a new article for Paranoia Magazine. Probably won't make it till the summer issue at this point, Ron, unfortunately.
Hey, that's okay. No problem. Look forward to it.
Right on, man. Well, I totally appreciate you coming on the show. I'm looking forward to seeing you here in San Diego at the Paranoia Con in just a few months. And until then, take care.
Excellent. Thanks again. I hope to come back on and give you an update in the future of all the great stuff that's happening.
Absolutely, man. Enjoy the day.
Thank you, sir. You too.
Wow. Well, there we go, people. Pretty enlightening stuff. Ron, what'd you think of that one? Did you like that?
I thought it was excellent. Frater X is very articulate.
Yes.
Compelling. It was really mind-boggling, though. I enjoyed how he was able to break things down, you know, as far as the evolution and de-evolution of human consciousness and the usurping of, you know, knowledge and wisdom. So it was a great show.
Yeah, man, I loved it. And I can never get tired of looking into that stuff. I mean, the alternative is pretty vast, and it seems like we've been manipulated to believe a whole wrong end of the spectrum, and it's never boring to go deep into what's possibly the true reality. But I wanted to give you a minute to talk about ParanoiaCon before we get out of here. And you've got a pretty decent lineup. I think you've got most of it kind of fleshed out. You got some topics as well. You want to give those to the people?
Sure. Once again, the ParanoiaCon will happen August 2nd and 3rd. And I'll have some information on my website within the next few days. But I'll have 8 speakers. So 4 speakers per day. We'll have Marie D. Jones, who's been on the Higher Side Chats. She's going to talk about viral disinformation, the mechanics, lies, rumors, and disinformation. We're also going to have Frater X, who's going to talk about and elaborate on the secret war on human consciousness. And then Corey Munez from Los Angeles is going to talk about the dangers of GMOs and sort of an update on the evil corporation Monsanto. We'll also have a paranoia writer, Naveed Khan, who's going to talk about Islamophobia, an in-depth look at anti-Muslim propaganda. And then a good friend of mine and editor of Paranoia Magazine, Ilana Freeland, is going to talk about her upcoming book, which is being published by Feral House, titled Chemtrails, HARP, and the Total Dominant Spectrum of Planet Earth. And then... two individuals who I met at the UFO Congress conference back in February are also going to be presenters at the ParanoiaCon. Clifford Mahudi is going to be speaking on extraterrestrial origins from a Native American perspective. And finally, David Weatherly, who's going to talk about his book, Strange Intruders, Anomalous Entities of the Paranormal. Once again, you can go to www.paranoiamagazine.com for updates on the ParanoiaCon, and it'll be reasonably priced as well.
That's awesome, man. I hope we can really blow this one up. We got to get out there and hang some posters with that kind of with the stuff you just mentioned, because I don't have a job now. So put me to work, man. We can definitely make it happen. But I love today's episode. Thanks to both Frater X and Ron Patton for being here today. I can't wait for the con. That about does it for us, people. You know I'm hawking t-shirts over at conspiratees.net. I know I'm out of a lot of sizes and designs. I'm sorry about that. I'm getting closer to having new designs every day. And of course, we're getting to the halfway point of this round of the Money Bomb. We're already at the $200 mark, so $100 for me and $100 for one of you, because this is a symbiotic relationship. I couldn't do it without you fine people. And with that, take care of yourself out there. And keep the wise words of Michael Rupert with you when you can. And I'll see you next week. Your move, Masons.
There was a decorated general with a heart of gold that likened him to all the stories he told of past battles won and lost and legends of old. A seasoned veteran in his own time. On the battlefield, he gained respectful fame with many medals of bravery and stripes to his name. He grew a beard as soon as he could to cover the scars on his face and always urged his men on. But on the eve of a great battle with the infantry and dream, the old general tossed in his sleep and wrestled with its meaning. He awoke from the night to tell what he had seen and walked slowly out of his tent. All the men held tall with their chests in the air, with the courage in their blood and a fire in their stare. And it was a great morning and they all wondered how they would fare till the old general told them to go home. He said, I have seen the others and I have discovered that this fight is not worth fighting. And I've seen their mothers, and I will no other to follow me where I'm going. So take a shower and shine your shoes, you got no time to lose. You are young men, you must be living. Take a shower and shine your shoes, you got no time to lose. You are young men, you must be living. Go now, you are forgiven.
But the men stood fast with their guns on their shoulders, not knowing what to do with the contradicting orders. The general said he would do his own duty, but he extended no further. The men could go as they pleased.
but not a man moved. Their eyes gazed straight ahead till one by one they stepped back and not a word was said. And the old general was left with his own words echoing in his head. He then prepared to fight. He said, I have seen the others and I have discovered that this fight is not worth fighting. No. And I've seen their mothers and I will no other to follow me where I'm going. So, take a shower and shine your shoes. Oh, you got no time to lose. You are young men, you must be living. Yeah. Take a shower and shine your shoes. Oh, you got no time to lose. You are young men, you must be living. Go now, you are forgiven. Go now, you are forgiven. Go now, you are forgiven. Go. Yeah. Go now, you are forgiven. Go now, you are forgiven. Go now, you are forgiven. Go.